From Bright Umbrella, this is Control ClickCast. We inspect the web for you. Today, we're talking about practical pricing with special guest, Brad Weaver. I'm your host, Leah Alcantara, and I'm joined by my fab co-host,
Emily Lewis.
This episode is brought to you by Mithra 62's Backup Pro, a complete backup solution for WordPress, Expression Engine 2 and 3, Craft, and PrestaShop. We use this one ourselves for some of our client sites. It's insanely customizable and includes automated backup integrity, 8 built-in storage locations, console routing. Basically, Backup Pro is built to make disaster recovery as painless as possible. And to make it even less painful to have you and your client sites backed up, Mithra 62 is offering 50% off of all versions of Backup Pro when you use the code CONTROL plus CLICK. We'll have the exact spelling in the show notes. And it's valid until February 12th. Just visit backup-pro.com to get started.
Before we get into today's episode, I wanted to remind our listeners we have a donate link on our site. So if you love Control Click and have a little spending money, consider donating to help us keep the show going. $1, $5, whatever you can spare will help us continue to deliver great content, high quality audio, and transcripts for each and every episode. Now to today's episode. We have talked about pricing on Control Click before, and it was a great episode that really focused on how important pricing is to sustain and grow a business. Today, we're going to take the pricing discussion even further, focusing on practical, actionable things you can do right now to help improve how you price your services, whether you're a freelancer or a web agency owner or even a small business owner. Our guest is Brad Weaver, who is the managing partner and chief experience officer at Nine Labs in Atlanta, Georgia. Brad is a UX generalist with expertise in product development, interactive, branding, and market segmentation. Welcome to the show, Brad.
Hey, how are you guys?
Great.
Awesome.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. Can you tell our listeners a bit more about yourself?
Sure. So yeah, day to day, as Emily said, I am the chief experience officer at Nine Labs, which is a firm here in Atlanta. We work with clients in the consumer and business space, doing mostly what you would call user experience work. And that ends up being UI design and development and applications, all of those, you know, things that end up being stuff that you use on your phone and on your computer. So we're definitely not a straight up dev shop or straight up design shop. We kind of have our hands in a lot of stuff. And that's how I spend most of my day. I've got this awesome team of designers that I get to work with every day. And other than that, I live in Atlanta where it's freezing right now, which is rare for us. And no snow, though. We still haven't seen any. And I just, you know, really am passionate about the stuff that we're going to talk about today, which is what I spend a lot of my time is mentoring other business owners and people starting their own practice, in addition to speaking at conferences and randomly tweeting about movies and whiskey and UX design for the most part. Yeah.
That's like the perfect segue to our first question, which was, you know, before we get into actual tips, how did you start giving pricing and business advice? Because you come from a design background. So how did that happen?
Yeah. So I was in corporate for almost a decade. I worked for Verizon and American Eagle before that. And that's where I learned how to do what we do. There weren't really schools for user experience design, and I had learned what you would call web design, I guess, but got pretty fed up. You know, it's nice to get promoted, but you get promoted to the point that you don't actually do any work anymore, which is what happened to me. And so I started a freelance practice on the side for the last couple of years in my corporate job in the mid-2000s, and decided in 2007 to just take the leap and open my own shop and leave my cushy corporate job. And so for 7 years, I had my own practice from 07 to 14. And it ranged from just being me as a solo freelancer to I had a staff of up to 5 at some points and then a few freelancers working for me. And eventually I merged with my current business partner. In that time, I mean, I had tremendous success and tremendous failure. In the introduction of my book, I share a pretty personal story. I've had people kind of tell me they're pretty surprised at the level of detail I share, but I almost lost my house. I literally ended up in the hospital due to overwork and exhaustion, and it was all the result of bad business practices, and it wasn't neglect or laziness or anything like that. It was just bad time management and it was bad pricing strategy. And I fixed it. I grew it. I built this awesome business that, you know, eventually my business partner, who's pretty well known in the industry, liked what I was doing so much that he wanted to be a part of it. And that's why I'm a chief experience officer now, and I don't call myself owner or a guru. but I'm still a 50% partner in the business. I help make a lot of the financial decisions, and but only one of us can be the CEO, and I prefer that he do that because I still like doing the work. I'm still a user experience designer. And that's a call we made, and he's great at it and I'm great at it, and it works because he buys into this. You know, he believes in the same stuff, so we work great together. And it frees me up to do this kind of stuff and to speak at conferences and mentor young business owners and you know, write a book and write stuff that I wouldn't be able to do if I was doing everything on my own. So partnerships, which, you know, is something I firmly believe in, if you find the right one, can be the next step in evolution. So that's why I give business advice, because I have the time and the experience and the scars from it.
Right. So I feel like you just described the after, right?
Yeah.
You kind of glossed over the tough times.
Yeah.
I'm a little curious over, you know, those times. Like, how have your views regarding pricing and business evolved over the years?
They have, big time.
Yes.
As they should. I mean, you know, I say this with humility and sincerity, but I'm a nice guy. I'm like a really nice guy, as you can tell by listening to me. I have a Southern accent. I'm from the South, and I'm not sheepish. I'm a big guy. I'm assertive, and I'm all that stuff. But I'm a people pleaser, and I don't like saying no. And when it comes to pricing and standing your ground, saying no to work and certain prices and hiring people that you want to work for you and all that stuff is hard, but it's critical. You have to learn to say no. And I think that in a passion-filled business, it's really easy to want to say yes. I mean, I have designers that I admire that their 2016 resolution was saying yes to everything, like the Jim Carrey movie or something. And I'm like, yes, I get that. I'm not calling what they're doing foolish. But when it comes to pricing, you can't say yes to every project. You can't say yes to every negotiation, obviously. But my views really changed, you know, when things went really bad for me in 2009 and 2010. I stopped reading other people's books in the industry and started looking at economics and real business strategies and not how everybody else was running a creative shop, because a lot of people were running their shops in the ground. And so I stopped reading all those creative business books and blogs. And honestly, most of them were pretty bad. Some new ones have come out that are good. I studied cost plus pricing and other models that made more sense. And you know, the one thing that stood out to me is how wrong service-based businesses are about profit. That was the linchpin. That was where the light bulb went out, went on for me. And when I changed my approach to profit, it just changed everything. And that's where I'm at now, is a profit-driven approach. And that sounds bad to some people, but when you dig into what I mean by that, it's the right call if you want to keep doing this.
And just to give our listeners a little backstory, so I guess it was about 4 months ago, Brad, we had a 90-minute, two-hour-long phone call with you to talk about exactly what we're talking about today on the podcast. And that was one of the first things that you said that really connected with me was, you know, wanting to make profit, to me, does sound a little bad, or did before you and I talked. But then you explained, like, if you have no profit, you cannot grow. You can't do the things you want to do, not only in your business, but in your personal life. And that doesn't mean, you know, for me, making profit doesn't have to mean I've got some mansion and fancy cars. It could just mean that I can take time off to enjoy my quality of life. Profit isn't a bad word.
No, it's not. You know, and I understand. I mean, especially in our 99% world, and most of the people that what we do are a more liberal generation, and that's a word that gets a bad rap, and we have to uncouple it from how it's been hijacked by big corporations and that stuff. Profit does not mean not taking care of people.
Or you know, another thing that I think connected with me as well was, I feel like pricing for me, when I was solo freelance and also even up until our conversation with you, it was one of those situations that I kind of felt uncomfortable. There was some sort of underlying emotional anxiety presenting, you know, a number to a client. And I think what was useful about our conversation with you, and I hope is what our listeners will take away today, is that if you actually do the math and follow the formulas to figure out what it takes for your businesses to, like, it just exists to get by, and then figuring out what profit is on top of that, then it's no longer emotional. You simply use that formula. The number you present to your client is simply what it takes you to operate your business.
Yeah.
That's all it is. It's not, it's because it's just a much more focused, strategic way of pricing than what I had done previously.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like, you know, it's just the word profit is such a loaded word, mm-hmm. you know, just the term profit. Because for me, like when I think about it, profit is really about sustainability, because if you don't have profit, then you don't have a business. Mm-hmm. The amount of profit, that can vary, you know, but you need to have profit or else you're actually paying your clients instead of the other way around.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and I mean, how do you end up paying your bills at that point, right? Because mm-hmm. I feel like, you know, especially when you see like all those crazy CNN or like financial shows where it's like profit with the giant fonts and the yelling and the market and the, and it just gets overwhelming, especially when you are a creative person mm-hmm. or a technical person who has no business training or background, and you went into this due to passion, as you mentioned in the beginning. And so there's kind of a stigma over like, why should you earn money if you are already passionate about mm-hmm. this and you like it? When the thinking should be, you should earn money because you are passionate about mm-hmm. it. You know?
Yep, absolutely. You guys got it.
So I think Leah and I were sort of talking about, you know, there's some perception issues. There may be some emotional issues. Do you think there's anything else that contributes to people pricing their services poorly?
Yeah. The most common is fear of losing the work.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Right.
We just don't, honestly don't know how good you have to be. I don't think you can be good enough to have a pipeline as full as it should be. Unless you get to that point, and I think this is more common with like illustrators and people like that, that have a lot of inbound requests. But in, especially in the web space, I mean, some of the best website designs in the world, even other web designers don't know who did them, you know? And
right.
so work is just not going to show up at your door. Even like, you know, some super talented people like Mike Montero have said, you know, he'd be lying if he told you that he wasn't worried about where the next client's going to come from. So fear of losing the work, I think, is most common. Mm-hmm. And I think people just go with what feels right. And I mean, it's an emotional job. They ask what others are charging and just charge that as well. And when they have to come off of that rate or price, they just end up losing money. Like Leah said, you just work for free. And when you use flat prices or project pricing, which is a pretty common model, especially in web design and development, we suck at estimating. We're just not good at it. Mm-hmm. It's not easy. Mm-hmm. And when you combine all that with the nebulous and unknown nature of what we do and just this perpetual just Murphy's Law that we live under, just crap goes wrong with what we do all the time, it's just a pretty bad business to be in if you're going to rely on guesswork. So,
right.
But we're emotional. It's what makes us creative. It's really hard to remove that emotion. I don't think it's feasible to do that. But, you know, even if you try to get mathematic about it, you know, there's these surveys out there, a lot of these recruiting companies put out and stuff. You know, they'll say that this is what you should make and this is what you should charge. But, you know, the sum of bad advice is still bad advice.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So if you're getting bad advice from a bunch of people who don't know what they're supposed to be charging, that doesn't mean that it's good advice just because somebody mm-hmm. compiled it. And I think that those are tend to be the fixes that people lean on and, you know, that they're just not going to fix it for you ever.
And I feel like we often, or at least I felt like I often heard so much through the years about pricing, but it wasn't specific. It was just like, you should raise your rates. Well, to what? Like, what do I determine what I raise my rates to? It seems so random. Or you should charge what you're worth. I'm like, well, I don't think I even know what I'm worth. But that's what you hear. And so you're like, all right, I'm doing something wrong, but I don't know what the right thing is.
Yeah.
And that leads me to my next question, which was, the whole reason we started talking to you a few months ago is Leah saw your presentation at Converge, and you were talking about pricing, and one of the things you brought up was the concept of a base rate, also known as a shop rate, and then a billing rate. Can you define these terms for us?
Yeah. So, you know, the thing is that, like I was saying before, we tend to go with what the market says or what we've been charging in the past, and we're flying blind when we do that because my situation is not your situation. Even if we live in the same city and do the same thing with the same experience, it's just different. So we kind of go by what we think makes sense. And you'll hear me use this phrase often. I'll probably use it more than once in this podcast is your gut is not a calculator and you can't figure this stuff out in your head. So you need to know what you need to make to not only to survive, but to thrive. And this ShopRate that is a linchpin of what I, you know, lead people to do is a basis for all pricing calculations. And it's what helps you determine if you're profitable and if the client, their project fits your business needs, whether you can take the work or not. It helps you determine if they're of value to you. And it's basically, it puts you in a position to flip the conversation around and put you in the driver's seat. You're shopping your clients when you do it this way rather than being shopped. And, you know, you only have so many hours in the day. And even if you've got a team, you still collectively have a limited amount of time that you can do this stuff. And you're selling your time for money, and time is the only resource that we can't ever have more of.
Right.
And if you want to thrive in this thing and not struggle and not just basically make a paycheck, you got to find out what it costs to run your business with a profit and determine how much of your time you can give to each client to get there. And that gives you a shop rate that is gospel in my house.
And that shop rate, this is everything. Like, you have to be really honest with yourself about where you are spending, and not like, well, this is what we, you know, should spend, mm-hmm. but what you are currently spending right now, everything from your salary, your staff salary, contractors, lease, licenses, everything.
Yeah. And, you know, it's math, which is not fun for even those of us that do development at times. You know, development is algebra, but it's not the kind that makes you want to grit your teeth. So there's definitely, you know, a lot of math behind it. I mean, we're on a podcast, not a video. I'd be glad to break it down if you want, but if people can follow, but I don't know if we want to do that, but yeah.
So, well, actually, Brad, instead of us getting into the details of the formula, I think it's a good time now to mention to our listeners that you have a book coming out that's going to have all of this information in it, resources for readers to figure out their own rates and estimating and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah, the book is, the book's called Creative Truth, and it's out at the end of February. And we do go into breaking down this base rate, which is expenses plus profit divided by hours. So it's this really simple formula on the surface that is a process that you have to go through to really get to the heart of what it takes to make your business work. And obviously, that's not the sum of the book. It's really detailed on how to start and build a profitable mm-hmm, design right. business. So, and when I say start, the book is not geared towards people who are just now deciding to start, although it's certainly applicable for them. But the advice in there is advice that, self-advice, I guess. Some of it I didn't take up until my fourth year in business and fifth year in business on the start end of it in the first half of the book. And then certainly the profit stuff I'm still learning every day. So, you know, if you want to know how to set this shop rate, that's a huge part of it. And then what to do with it is a huge part of it. But most importantly, you know, I want people to be protected when they're building mm-hmm. a business and really know where they're going. And like Leia said earlier, you know, you can have a passion and you can follow that passion and you can build an awesome business with it, but it's not going to be in business very long if you're not making what you're supposed to make.
And speaking of that, Leia, so right after we got off the phone with Brad, the first thing you did was figure out what our shop rate was.
Right.
So what was that experience like? Was it overwhelming? I mean, be honest.
Well, okay.
I had you do it because I thought it would be overwhelming.
Well, in a word, yes, it was. And I feel like, though, in some ways, and I'm sure our longtime listeners know this, Emily and I are sticklers and who love to-do lists. And one of the other stickler things that we do is we log almost everything essentially that we do that's billable and unbillable. So anything we do just for Bright Umbrella, as well as our client work. So we started off in a good place in that we had this data to work off of. So when we had spoken to Brad earlier, he explained how to create the shop rate. And part of it is, like, it's really seeing where you're spending your time and having an honest discussion about that, as well as, you know, essentially doing an expense report of your entire business and kind of aligning the two of them. And this involves a lot of spreadsheets, and Brad gave us kind of like a starting point, but we realized that some of the terms that he used didn't really apply to our particular language for Bright Umbrella. So it took me a while to be able to translate some of the things that I was calculating. But I think what was the biggest eye-opener was, even when we thought we were billing our rate, we weren't billing our rate. Right?
Yes.
And that was the craziest finding. And this is because we did log all our non-billable items as well, which probably should have been mostly billable too. So that was mistake number one, not billing, like misunderstanding what should be billable and what should not be billable. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when I was looking at our unbillable list items, we're like, maybe we should have charged for this. So that was number one. And then number two was when I added all of the time spent on this one project. And even though the invoice said a billing rate that we thought was fair, and, you know, even after I calculated, like, oh, yeah, this is a good billing rate, when I compared it to the actual full amount of hours and time and effort and value that we brought to this particular client, we were not even hitting our shop rate mm-hmm. because we were too much, like, really, you know, when we go back to the emotional thing, we're like, oh, you know, this might take 5 minutes. Right? And we're like, oh, okay, well, I like this client. It's not going to be a big deal. I'm just going to log the time as unbillable. And then the 5 minutes ends up 5 minutes here, 5 minutes there. Then suddenly I'm giving them 10 hours for free.
Yep.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm listening to you talking. I'm just angry at us. Well, because you said at the beginning, you and I are sticklers. We log everything, but we never looked at it.
That was the crazy thing is that we logged it for the current time to just see like what's happening right this second, but mm-hmm. we never paused to reflect and look back once the project was complete, whether any of that made sense. And like all clients, all our clients, just like we would do, they negotiated the rates, mm-hmm. right? And we crumbled way too quickly.
We never negotiated. We never negotiated really back.
We just mm-hmm. kind of said, oh, I guess that's, we're okay with this. But a lot of those decisions were made not with actual data. Mm-hmm. Like as in we just emotionally were like, okay, I guess this is okay. But now we have the data. We looked back and we're like, oh, this project actually made us lose money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Once you figured out our shop rate, that base rate, I realized that the biggest project we got last year that I was so stoked about, we actually lost money on.
Yeah.
Because once we knew what we needed to make, we realized we hadn't been making it, which is just such a, you know, it's an unfortunate way to learn a lesson, but I think it's pretty common when you right. go into business for yourself without any business yeah. background.
Well, it's just like about that reflection part, right? Because I feel like when you are in an agency or even when you're a freelancer, you're just always looking, okay, what's the next thing? How do I just keep working? Mm-hmm. As opposed to how do I work smarter so I'm not so exhausted?
So moving on from the base rate, Brad, what's different between your shop rate, your base rate, and what you bill? Like how, what's the difference between those two numbers?
The shop rate, to piggyback on what Leah was saying about negotiation is, you know, the worst situation you can be in any negotiation, you know, I don't care if you're trying to talk someone off of a ledge or negotiate a website project, is you've got to know your boundaries. You've got to know the line mm-hmm. that you cannot cross. For you as a business owner, the line you cannot cross is losing money.
Yes.
The line you should not cross is not making a profit. And the mm-hmm. line that I prefer that you not cross is not making a significant profit in building in your value. In order to understand that, you have to have the shop rate. And, you know, so without people who haven't read the book or don't get a chance to, you know, the shop rate tells you what you have to have, and that includes profit. Mm-hmm. And that's the important part. And when you have that factored in, so you factored in your all of your expenses, including those over the course of the year, you factored in your tax liability, and you factored in your profit, and you've divided that by the amount of time you can give, your inventory of hours, not how many hours there are in a week, how many hours you can sell. Then you know what an hour's worth, regardless of the pricing model that you use, hourly or whatever it is, which I don't recommend, actually. We'll talk about that in a second if you want. But the thing that you land on, the shop rate, is your point of the line you won't cross. It's the point of
right.
no return in a negotiation.
Right.
You then use that shop rate to understand how your projects are going, and you run your time against that, you run your materials against it, and so on. So to answer the question about the difference between that and a billing rate is going to be driven by what your market will bear, what's been offered. You know, a lot of times people tell you this is the billing rate we pay. There's a lot of factors that go into it, but the most important thing is that your billing rate is more than your shop rate. I mean, they could be the same. So let's say your shop rate's 150 an hour, then your billing rate can be 150 an hour. You're still making a profit and you're still paying everything on time because you've built profit into your shop rate, which is why it's critical that the profit is in there rather than trying to bolt it on later. So you're still doing okay and you're growing if you match your billing rate to your shop rate, but you're selling yourself short. And hopefully, especially in development, you're scaling your company so that you're hiring people that cost you, you know, $30, $35 an hour, which is like a $60,000 salary or something, and you're charging shop rate for their work. And that's where, as a business owner, you start to grow and thrive, and you're able to pay those people more and provide awesome benefits and create that micro Google atmosphere you want with foosball tables and free lunch. That stuff doesn't happen if you're not profitable, and it doesn't happen if your billing rate's all over the place. So the two things I look for in a billing rate is that it's more than your shop rate and it's what you can get. I know that's not the answer everybody wants, but I also don't use hourly billing in my business, so that's how I look at it.
Well, I think it's important to mention that the billing rate is going to change, like on a project per project as you're estimating and thinking of it. And that's what's been useful for me, is understanding the shop rate doesn't change, except I do want to interject one thing you did say to us is that you revisit your shop rate regularly. You take a good look at where the business stands expense-wise to make sure that that shop rate, like, you don't make the assumption that, oh, it's $150 and that's just what it is always.
No. Right now, I check it about every 3 months, or if we make a major hire, like a director-level position that's a six-figure salary, we have to revisit our rates. When we make a junior hire, like a junior designer or developer, typically the number of hours they add to our inventory and the amount of salary that they add to our cost is pretty level, because they typically can work 35, 40 billable hours a week, at minimum 30, and they tend to even out at that, especially here in Atlanta. It's a pretty reasonable market. You know, a director may only be able to give you 20 billable hours because a lot of their time is in meetings and strategy or acquisition. Right. So they can move it. The last director hire that we made shifted our shop rate by almost $15 because we had to go get somebody that was at a significant cost that we wanted to get and eat it for a little while so that we could grow with them. So it's a constant conversation. I mean, we're constantly checking in. I and my business partner run through it every 3 months, but we have a managing director that's staying on top of our expenses all the time.
Right.
Part of that shop rate is the annual expenses. And, you know, in the book, I break that down more, but the key thing is cutting out the surprises. So it's not like when we hire somebody, we got to go spend $4,000 on a MacBook Pro as well. We can't just go get other work to pay for that. And I'm not going to put that on a credit card and carry debt. That's why we forecast, along with the hire, we forecast all of that overhead. So that adds into it as well. So you got to adjust, because if I'm hiring, I wouldn't, but if, like, I was hiring a 3D developer that I've got to put on a $10,000 PC, I need a forecast for that. And so that's a big adjustment, my shop rate. That can be my shop rate, you know, $4 or $5, which could end up, you know, being a good bit of hours on a large project.
Yeah, I think it's one of the reasons that another one of the specific tasks that Leia and I set up for ourselves after Leia figured out the shop rate is that, you know, we have regularly scheduled check-ins, but now one of those check-ins is to talk about expenses and money and where we stand, where we did not have that. You know, we check in on the business, but not the financials. Mm-hmm. We just didn't. And now that's part of our regular approach.
And because of that, we're able to plan for certain things. You know, I feel like Emily and I were really lucky that we spoke to you earlier in 2015, that we were able to apply a bunch of things that you advised us to do almost immediately. And that allowed us, I remember in December, our chat over, like, okay, we have this much extra in the bank now. And so first of all, that was yay. We have stuff in the bank that we're not, and like all taxes and expenses are paid. So first of all, we were just thrilled for that. But the other thing was, is that now we were able to have discussions over, like, well, what can we do with this money to help the business be even better, you know, and plan for certain eventualities. Like you said, like, how do I forecast for this? We know that we want to go to a different type of conference each year, but instead of just like, oh, can we afford it? Can we not? Now we have been able to plan for it, so it is a guarantee to happen, as yeah. opposed to like, maybe if we get this client, then this. Because we have been a lot more responsible about our pricing and our discussions about expenses, we're actually able to now plan for these future things for our business, as opposed to like, if we have stuff left over.
You know, just to throw in another little anecdote, like Leia's what really stoked that we have some extra money. I'm just stoked we paid our taxes, because 2 years ago, I got hit with a $20,000 tax bill because yeah. I didn't have a sense of how much money I was bringing in. I was paying the minimum of my quarterly estimated taxes. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not like I didn't pay what was due, mm-hmm. but we made more and I didn't think about it and I didn't pay any attention to it. And it was probably the scariest thing I can remember happening yeah. in the course of owning the business. And just thank God I had savings, because otherwise we wouldn't be here as a business talking. Yeah. Is basically yeah. what it comes down to, which is scary when you think about it. I mean, I don't know what I would do without this. I don't want to work for anybody else. So, yeah. you know, that's even more serious. Like, that's why you have to look at this stuff. And I still can't believe we are only just now figuring this out.
Let's take a step back here. As we spoke earlier, this is emotional. Even though it's business, it's mm-hmm. our yeah. business.
Yeah.
We're the ones making these decisions. And again, this is work that we enjoy doing. So there's all of those things that happen. Brad, I actually appreciate how open you were over your struggles. And you said, like, it took you year four before you started, like, I better have some process here yeah. than just flying off the seat of your pants.
Yeah.
And Bright Umbrella, we're just heading into year two.
Yeah.
Let's think about that, Emily.
Well, yeah, but I'm heading into year seven. On my own.
I mean, yes.
Yeah, but what I'm saying sure. is, I think this is what this reveals, a deficit in mm-hmm. our industry of totally. Where we talk all the time about best practices for design, user experience, front end development, you know, but I don't ever hear anything more than you should price what you're worth. Yep. You know, I don't hear the specifics. You don't hear about a huge agency having to lay off everybody until mm-hmm. after it's happened. Like, and then no one tells you what happened and how they recover from it. So, yeah. you know, you almost have to be like, all right, I'm going to learn about economics and I'm going to learn about this stuff, or I'm going to find someone like Brad who's going to help me figure out what I need to know. But I mean, I think that's why these sort of specific conversations are very, very important, especially in the creative services industry. But I want to keep giving our listeners some really actionable information. So I want to talk about something you touched on, Brad, where you said you don't price your projects hourly. Mm-hmm. So what do you do? How do you approach, you know, pricing a project?
Yeah, it's true. I hourly is virtually non-existent at Nine Labs, and in my past company, I very rarely used it as well. You know, and the shop rate is, you know, how much each hour is worth, and how you deliver those hours as far as how they end up in a proposal is where you have flexibility. But how much they're worth doesn't necessarily mean that's what you sell them for, which I think is right. the mistake that we often make. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like if you owned a car lot, it's like selling all of your cars at invoice. You're fine, but is that really what you want to do? So for us, I mean, to be fully transparent, I mean, you guys have learned, and hopefully the readers will learn if they check out the book and stuff, is that I'm very transparent to a fault. My wife hates it at times. So like my business's shop rate is 197. That's exactly what it is right now. Our billing rate is 250. We don't use that billing rate often, and it's scary enough that most people don't want to pay us hourly. So we got there because that's what our market will bear. People are mm-hmm. willing to pay $250, and we'll talk about hourly with them in that scenario with some really strict timelines on how we do things. But there are seven pricing models. I, you know, in the workshops that I teach and conference talks that I do, and definitely in the book, I break all seven of those down. They're, you know, this hourly is obviously the most common, and flat and project-based pricing, you know, it's kind of this project costs this much and you'll get these things, is pretty common. And there's value-based and retainers and so on. And they're all good. I wouldn't recommend a model that's not good. There's tons out there that don't make sense for this industry, but all seven are viable. So I would never tell someone, don't use that one. I would tell most people, don't use only one. I think it's a mistake to only use one as well, because different situations call for different stuff. And we have Nine Labs, I'd say we use four different ones pretty commonly. We use value-based pricing as our core approach. We use value-based retainers, which is a little different way to do things. We use package pricing, and we use equity pricing. at times. Those are the four that come up when we look at a client. I don't want to get into this in too much detail. I want to give away, you know, a lot more tips, but you know, there's not a big difference between value-based pricing and flat fee pricing in the client's perception. So I think that's important to note that, you know, I say value-based pricing, and then if you saw one of my proposals, you'd be like, that's a flat fee. And there's a huge difference underneath the hood, but what the client sees is no different.
So let's talk about that under the hood, because you provided us a copy of a Google spreadsheet that was like an estimating spreadsheet that you had used yourself. It had some formulas built in and some various things that you use to price projects. And basically, Leah and I took it and customized it for how we approach projects and also how our minds sort of think of these things. So can you describe sort of the process of putting together this worksheet and what you had in mind and what the end goal of this worksheet's supposed to provide? And then maybe Leah and I can describe why we customized it, how we customize it, and how it works for us.
Yeah. Well, you guys did an amazing job. Thank you for sharing yours. And I think I'll probably end up having to pay you guys to use yours. No, I mean, you know, and Leah made a great point earlier about the shop rate calculations and the stuff that's in the book is, you know, she had to customize a lot of stuff because it was difficult for her to marry the terms of what you guys talk about and what I talk about. And so Creative Truth, as both a workshop and a book and a methodology, is written for graphic designers, web designers, photographers, illustrators, and writers, and web developers and software developers. So I don't want to be a mile wide and an inch deep. I still don't want to alienate that audience, because what you said earlier, Emily, is that people are talking about this, but most of the stuff out there is not great. And I'll recommend some stuff to you guys that I do think is good. But the result of that is that this process is, you've got to customize it. I can't give you here's a bunch of spreadsheets and your business is going to be perfect. And I'm not trying to sell somebody consulting. I run an agency. I'm not interested in being a guru. But like with you guys, I hate seeing businesses struggle. And if I can give away a little bit of my time to help some people, maybe I have to monetize that later. I don't know, because life's that way. But that's not interesting to me as much as like, here's a tool that you guys go and customize. And like, you did a great job with that. And the purpose of that spreadsheet is to ask the questions you may just not think about getting those numbers together. So, you know, there's estimations when it comes to estimating a project, and there's estimations when it comes to estimating your shop rate as well. And I think that as long as you're real with yourself, that's the most important thing when doing this. So whatever tool you use, I find it, and we were guilty of it for so long. It's like the client gave us a number, and then we tried to fit as much work as possible into that number, which is just backward. It's like, no, it's going to take this much time. This is our shop rate. That's the final. And if it's 30% over the client's budget, then guess what? One of two things have got to happen. Cut features and deliverables or give us more money. Otherwise, you can't do the work. And I think that's the linchpin of understanding this, is that
totally
we look at it and we go, I want the work. Well, you can want it all you want, but I mean, if you're going to lose money doing it, don't do it. Mm-hmm. Like, it just doesn't make sense. It doesn't matter. I don't care who it is. You know, it just, they're going to do that. So I think you guys did a phenomenal job of how you're estimating things. And I think that, like you said, you guys are looking at a lot of your operational costs differently than some people might, in a good way. And I think with development, that's smart, because you have a lot of purchases and stuff like that you have to make. Whereas with design, that's not typically the case, other than maybe stock photography. And you've got to set budgets for those. At my company, we treat our non-billable employees like rent and furniture. So like my project managers, my admin, they don't factor into our hour inventory. We don't charge clients for their services. Project management is necessary for us to get the job done. But, you know, there are a lot of things that you just don't think about in an estimate.
Totally.
And you've got to have a consistent system for doing that, but that's also got flexibility to where it can be customized to whatever project you have. And I don't know. I mean, like, I think that I can give people the base of what they need to, the type of information that needs to be in it, but you've got to figure out for your business what specific information you've got to track.
That's what I thought was so useful about the worksheet that you gave us, is while we approach our projects differently and we line item things differently, perhaps is the right term, we weren't even doing it though.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I'd say, Leia, how long will it take you to make some comps? She's like, 10 hours. I'm like, cool. And that was it.
Yeah. And we didn't think about like how many times we have to do back and forth with the client. How many times do we?
Like, we were not factoring in core project management. And that's really critical because in a small team where we are, where that stuff may be perceived as non-billable to the client, it's actually billable. And yeah. While we don't necessarily want to bill that to the client on an hourly basis, we have to factor in that it takes us, you know, 10 hours to do this, all this administrative stuff. And that has to be built into that flat rate or value-based pricing, that number that we present to the client, because otherwise we're losing money. Like, we proved we can lose money. Like, that's yeah. what we, you know, that's why I thought the worksheet was so invaluable, because it was like, oh, well, let me think about all the different things that happened during this phase. And yeah. I turned them into line items. And so now we may not put in a number in that field because it may be irrelevant to a project, but we ask ourselves, is that going to be relevant?
Yes.
If it's not, we move on. If it isn't, we put in a number. And then it's accounted for, instead of Leia saying, oh, well, you know, it takes me this long to make some comps. Well, that's great, but also takes, you know, 20% on top of those 10 hours to communicate with the client, to go back and forth internally, you know, anything.
Yes. Yeah.
And we just weren't accounting for it. And I felt like your worksheet, Brad, it was a light bulb of saying, oh, I could really break down all of our processes into things that will help me calculate what it really takes to make this project come to life.
But I have to say, like, I think the biggest takeaway for all of that too, and it does bear repeating, is that there are two options, you know, if a client has a fixed budget. You just either remove features mm-hmm. or they give you more money. Literally is that. And it actually just happened yesterday we had a client who gave us this laundry list of stuff. All right. So we used our new estimating spreadsheet and we thoroughly put everything in there. We really thought about it. We also thought about the particular relationship we had with this client. Now, keep in mind that part of the reason we're able to even do all of this is because we built a relationship with the client. So mm-hmm. pricing isn't just because we're adding a bunch of numbers. It's because we're confident with the relationship we have with this client. So we sent this client the estimate based on her laundry list of stuff. And she didn't out and out say that was way too much, but she's like, actually, let's cut this all down to this one request now, you know? And then we're like, that's cool. We reestimated the one request that, like, she literally cut down all her wish list. And then she accepted that estimate.
Yeah.
So we still got the work.
Yeah.
That's the key.
Go.
We still have the relationship. We know we're going to get our billable hour. Or billable, you know, whatever, we're going to get our shop rate instead of not.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the worksheet, you know, once people get an opportunity to get your book and see the resource and find, it's, I think the key is just customizing it for yourself. Mm-hmm. You know,
right.
We broke ours down according to the typical phases that we follow in a project. We built in for the fact that we always fail to factor in project management. We built in for expenses and how we manage expenses and invoice those. And then we even built in like a special, you know, we split it into tabs where it might be special requests that aren't part of a typical project that have to be looked at separately. And those are typically the things that might be options that we present to a client, but they're still broken down and factored in. So it feels, I feel like a grown-up business person having this thing. I think that's the best way to put it. I feel like, and it's hard to feel bad asking for a certain amount of money when you're like, this is what it's going to take.
This is it in black and white. Yeah.
There's no, oh, we're doing you a favor, or, you know, I feel like I'm supposed to. This is what it's going to take.
And also the important thing with knowing your shop rate as well as your billing rate is that it's still your business. As long as you never go lower than your shop rate, there's flexibility between the shop rate and billing rate. So let's say you quote something into a client, which is the, you know, your full billing rate, and then they get back to you with something a little bit under that. If it's still above your shop rate and it's still something that you find fair, then it's possible something that you don't have to remove a feature in order to get it done because it's still within your profitable, you know, safe space. As long as it just doesn't go below the shop rate. The shop rate is like the line you just don't cross. That's the line where you have to start saying no and removing features.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, I have this matrix, and I actually have like a napkin sketch of it in the book where it's my project decision matrix, and it's basically three columns. And it's like the number we start from a profit standpoint, is 40%. And I want to point out that's on top of the shop rate. So there's 20% profit built into the shop rate. And you guys have this in your estimating worksheet as well. You're targeting 40%, which is a great number. You look at a project and you say, okay, do I want to do this project? Is the question you ask yourself. Decision matrix. If the answer is hell yes, then I will consider going all the way down to 10 or 20% profit, which is still technically 30% profit or 40% profit.
Right.
Say yes. If my answer is yes, then I'll consider going down 20, 30% profit, probably 30. If my answer is maybe, 40% profit or I walk away. Mm-hmm. And that's and maybe doesn't mean that I'm not interested. Maybe just mean that like we've already done five like this. It's not going to improve our portfolio. It's whatever. Mm-hmm. And all the stuff you guys said, the most important thing is you've removed the emotion from the things that shouldn't be emotional so that you can get emotional about doing excellent work, pushing to the next level, writing cleaner code, better documentation, better designs, having fun with it, taking longer at lunch to talk to the client or whatever because you know that flex is built in with your project time.
Yes.
All the stuff that makes the job fun, it all goes away when you're struggling and you're in the rat race.
Yes.
And it's just like it's a temporary pain to figure out what this is, to lose some clients. You will lose some clients when you raise your rates. That will happen. You will lose work when you raise your rates. People who came to you before, you're too expensive for them now. You got to suck that up and deal with it if you want to do fun work for interesting clients for the long term.
I think what you just said really resonates clearly with me right now because we just finished some work with a client we've had for quite a long time, but we'd always been in the situation of, and I think it's worth mentioning, this is a client that we bill hourly and we intend to continue billing hourly because of how they just they're like, oh, and this, and this, and this. And there's almost no way to keep the scope very fixed. But we still would give them estimates of how long we thought something would take. And invariably, we were going over those estimates and not billing for the time we were taking, consulting with them and really getting to understand what they're looking for and what they need so that we can make the best decisions for them. And now that we're using this worksheet, you know, the estimates we're giving them, they have all this built in. So I never feel like we just have to give them something that we can also take the time to ask them, well, why are you asking for this?
Yeah.
Well, maybe this would make a better fit here because that's what Leigh and I love to do. Like, yeah, we love our production work, but we really love to bringing value to our clients and understanding why. Yeah. We don't just want to implement stuff.
Yeah. We're not just worker monkeys.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And when we have these accurate estimates that we've paid close attention to versus what we were doing before, we can bring that value even more. We're not just building something for them. We're helping them make the right decisions for their business. And that's really satisfying. Instead of being like, oh, we're through 2 hours from crossing the budget. We can't do anything more than this.
Yeah.
Which feels terrible.
Yeah.
It feels terrible.
Yeah. Like when you estimated it properly and we're actually giving them a well-intentioned idea of how much the costs will be, then when we provide value, and usually because Emily and I are experts, we provide it at a faster clip than normal, and we already know they've accepted a certain budget, then we can say yes to some of their simpler extra questions because there is still room in the budget.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, as opposed to, you know, we used to be in a position sometimes where we know this would help this client, but we're not even going to suggest it because we're already over budget.
Yeah.
And exactly. That feels awful as a professional because you're just like, I know this would take their site or their experience or this in the next level, but we just can't afford to even suggest it. You know, you just feel like a worse professional. So I feel like if anything that our listeners will take away from this is when you price yourself properly, when you price your projects properly, you actually are a better professional.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because you have the leeway to be professional.
Totally agree.
All right. So I also want to keep going with the practical stuff. I want to talk about some of they were like little scenarios or little scripts you told us that you use when you're talking to a prospect about getting them to reveal what they're working with in terms of budgeting.
Yeah.
I thought that was really useful because we've used them in our sales calls.
We totally have.
So let's talk about some of those ways you can get a prospect to reveal their budget and what they're working with.
Well, the first way is to ask, which is crazy, but to say, what's your budget, which blows my mind when I talk to people, how many won't just do that.
Right.
Which works probably half the time. So you don't have to go into Houdini stuff. If that doesn't work, yeah. I mean, I've got some scripts that I supply as far as voicemail scripts and email and so on and so forth that you can get into. But, you know, the thing you really want to get people to do is to agree to a discovery session, which is best for both of you. It's just a paid consulting session. You go through everything, you scope the project, and the deliverable is a tight scope of work with a model that works best for you both. Full transparency at Nine Labs, we charge $5,000 a day for a discovery, and we sell a lot of discovery. We're good at what we do, and we stand our ground when we say that if you want us to just blindly respond to an RFP, we're not going to do that. Right. I don't need the work enough. The main thing is that, you know, some clients take discovery, some don't. They're like, I'm not going to pay you anything. I don't know you. So then I offer them, I do this thing called a chief experience officer for hire. I offer them a 2-hour Skype session for $1,500, and we get to the heart of the problem there. It's a mini discovery. There's no delivery. It's more of an interview for me. Again, flipping the table by knowing your shop rate is, I now know if I want to work with this person and whether they're being authentic in their proposal. And if that doesn't work, then I just give them ranges. I tell them, you know, okay, well, I don't have a full understanding of it. So you tell me, is this something you're thinking is 10 to 30,000, 30 to 50,000, or 50 to 100? And we typically get an answer from that. You still have those few clients that'll be like, I still don't know. Well, then I think we're at a point where I probably don't want to work with you. You know, I'm amazed at the people who I think are going to come back and say, oh, you know, the 10 to 30 range. And they come back and they go, we're just trying to keep it close to 100. I mean, we had one of those a couple of weeks ago where I was like, okay, then. And that doesn't mean that I'm rubbing my fingers together and saying, ha, 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 you know, now we're going to get all this profit. It's like, okay, clearly I didn't understand what your expectations are, unless they're just foolish with their money. And then I'm going to be honest. I'm going to tell them, listen, you can do this for like 30 or 40, but if you've got a $100,000 budget to make this thing happen, can we look at doing these things for you? Because maybe they're just coming to us with a deliverable mindset. Like they're just going, hey, we need a new website. And their budget's 100. And I'm like, there's no way that there's not $100,000 worth of work here. And I mean, sure, you could cash that check and walk away with it. But like you guys said, I like solving problems. I'm gonna be like, listen, you know, you've got enough budget to really dig into some other stuff. So let's talk about where you want to be, not what you want. But the most important thing is I pick up the phone. I don't email people and ask them what their budget is. I'll email them and ask them about the discovery. But if they say no to that, I'm not going to start an email chain with them or something. It's you know, you got to soften those barriers. You know, people don't know. They don't know. I had a client that their this wasn't my work I was doing for them, but their competitors would call them and try to get estimates on budgets for competitive espionage.
Wow.
And people are – they're sensitive to that. You don't know what their experience is, that you don't know why they're not – maybe they're not – giving you a budget because they just don't want it in writing, maybe because they're accountable to an AP department, but verbally they'll tell you anything you want. They'll tell you the combination of their safe. And I think that that's really common, but we just don't respond blindly to RFPs. We ask for a discovery. We get on the phone. We try to get face to face if we can, if it's somebody we think there's a lot of value, but phone call's best. Don't waste your time. You know, if none of that works, then the main thing is that tells me, okay, I have to tighten the screws on how I work with this person if they still want to work together. We don't do the nebulous 6 months for, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollar budgets. We work in 2-week sprints or 1-month sprints at that point because I'm not going to commit. If I have no idea what your expectations are budget wise, I can't commit to a long term project. Small projects, you know, $10,000 website or something, it's fine. You just give them a price and maybe they take it, maybe they don't. Just make sure it covers your shop rate. But you're missing an opportunity for them to go, no, I've actually got 40, but I want this thing to have this stuff, and it's miscommunication, which ends up backfiring.
So, I mean, all this sounds great, but sometimes you do everything, quote, correctly. You know, you speak to them about their budget and all those kind of things, and everything seems like it's all in line. What do you do when there's resistance to that cost?
Well, we covered a lot of that, I think, and, you know, don't go into a negotiation not knowing where the line in the sand is. So knowing that shop rate and knowing your inventory, how many hours you have to give is really important. And then you can – a lot of times you can just say, you know, this just doesn't work, so you don't feel like you're being unfair. But let's say that, you know – we've given them a quote that's value-based. It's $20,000. Right. And they come back and they say, no, I can go get this five other places for $8,000.
Right.
And they're right. They can. You can get everything for cheap if you keep going. And it's like you know, the analogy I use is like, I could go to Target and buy my wife a purse for $40. I could go to Hermes and buy my wife a purse for $10,000, right?
Right.
It's about what you want and what you expect, you, the client. Right. The kind of person that walks into a Hermes store and says, oh, I can get a purse for $40 elsewhere, that's not your target customer.
Right.
End of discussion. Right. Those people, there's no winning with those people. And they'll show their true colors pretty early on, and you just need to walk away. Again, you need to have a full enough pipeline and a strong enough profit margin to be able to walk away, which is a learned behavior. But let's, you know, you're desperate for the work. You got to have it. You know, you're like, if we don't get another $10,000, $20,000 project, we're not going to make payroll. So the mistake that we make pretty often is you start listing your experience and all that stuff. You know what? They don't care. You start telling about how efficient you are and how great you are and all these people you've worked with. They don't care. They're a value, price conscious customer at that point. And the problem is that this is the Tower of Babel. We're responding to a commodity-minded person with a solutions-based answer. Mm. This is a person that sees buying what you're doing no different than going to stick with Target and buying detergent off the shelf at Target. They don't care what it takes to build a website and all that kind of stuff. And when there's resistance to that and you know, have kind of done all of these things, you really have to get yourself in a situation where you know how low you'll go. You've done, like I said, this hell yes, yes, maybe matrix. You've run through all these scenarios getting to this point, and they're still just like, you know, I just don't think that's fair. I think that's overpriced. Is that a client that you want? Do you think that that's going to go well when you're delivering subjective stuff for them? You know, if people are receptive to it and they come back and go, listen, we want to work with you, and they seem great and all that stuff, but they go, you're giving us 20, we've got 10, that's the ceiling. You know, cut features. Mm-hmm. The more importantly, ask them a question of where they're trying to go, not what they want. So often we're a hammer looking for a nail. It's like, hey, we sell websites. You want to buy a website. And that's not how to do this. If you want to be sustainable, it's asking, what is this thing going to do for you? Where do you want to be? And their response may be, we were just meeting with a guy this morning. He's, you know, there was a website solution and they said, no, we need 25 franchises by the end of the year. The website's not going to move them from 7 to 25 franchises. It's not. And we said, listen, let's spend, instead of spending $10,000 on refreshing the website, here's Squarespace. Let's spend $10,000 on a content strategy model and let's figure out how we market to your franchisees and explain the process better. Mm-hmm. We just stop selling the website altogether. That resistance is typically because they have a price in their head. And when you don't meet that expectation, they immediately just lock up. And you're not going to be able to untangle that through tricks. So as low as you can go, know what you have to make. Decide whether it's worth it to you to come down on your profit margins. And if you run through all those scenarios and you just can't make it work, you've got to be in a position where you can walk away.
And if I can just put a couple things out there with regard to those initial conversations, I pulled up the notes that I had from our call a couple months ago, Brad, and there were a couple of what I wrote down were conversational touch points. These were some of the things that we found have actually literally worked when we're talking to someone who's keeping their numbers close to the chest. And before I get to them, I think you're absolutely right. The talking to them. That's another thing that Leah and I instantly changed after our call with you, was that we are now, sales is always over the phone. It just is. Like, we're not going to take, we're good on the phone. And so I don't know why we kept avoiding it. I think it's because it's just easier to just shoot an email, but it doesn't get you the work. But anyways, here were a couple sentences you had suggested. Do you know what you have allocated for this? Or, this project sounds complicated. We want to use your investment wisely. It could be a five-figure project. How does that seem to you?
Yeah.
Before we waste any of your time, are you prepared with a budget? So it's like a different way of asking them what their budget is that might make them feel like you're not just being like, what's the number?
Yeah. Yeah. This is awful, right? That's like a hostage negotiation.
Exactly. But the key to being able to have those phrases that you could introduce is literally talking to the person. The same thing also when we had a prospect who we chose to move forward with putting a proposal together. In the past, we would just send the proposal. Now we schedule a call to go over the proposal with them.
Exactly.
And that was a suggestion that you had made to us as well, that, you know, talk to them about what you're sending them. Don't just send it and leave it out there. Mm-hmm. Go over it with them to get a sense of their tone, their response,
the tone
how they're receiving.
Everything, too.
I'll add to that that, you know, how we suck at saying no. Clients do too. When you get people, and this is not a trick, this is honest.
Yeah,
I mean this.
Right.
I don't think this is dishonest at all. When you get them on the phone, and if you can get them face to face or on Skype, it's even better. They're much more obligated to say yes to your proposal because they don't want to hurt your feelings.
Sure.
Honest to God, that's how Americans work.
That's funny. But I mean, it's true. Like, I'm just thinking about that time about the proposal I think that Emily's talking about. And I don't know, we were so scared before we did it because we're like, oh, this will be the first time we go through a proposal with a client. And, you know, we don't know what they're, you know, going to say. They were so calm that it was so clear because we had priced it a certain way that we're like, oh my gosh, if we had priced it, you know, a few months earlier, we would have underpriced it. And this is way more than we normally would have quoted earlier. Their tone of voice put us in ease immediately because it was so clear that they had no problem with the price.
Yep.
You know, and if you just send the proposal and you just twiddle your thumbs, all you're doing is worrying.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, and here, because they were on the phone immediately, we were put at ease because the cost, like that wasn't even an issue, which is actually blew my mind. Now the discussion over the proposal over was, what do these line items that you quoted us mean?
Yeah.
So we understand what we're paying for.
Mm-hmm.
And that was all really the, like, this was before they even signed it. I already knew we'd won the project within the first 5 minutes. You know, and that's like so empowering simply because we picked up the phone.
Yeah.
You know?
Crazy, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy.
It is.
Seriously, this could be a 2-hour podcast, but I think we need to wrap it up a little bit. But before we do, we should get some of the your best tips and resources books that you would recommend our listeners to reference.
Sure. Yeah. Well, obviously my book, I'm not going to lie. So yeah, and you can, so the book is called Creative Truth. The website is thecreativetruth.com because somebody's squatting on Creative Truth. Thanks, dude. they wanted like $5,000 for it. So thecreativetruth.com, it's out February 25th. It's on Amazon and publisher channels and all that kind of stuff. And I definitely think that I sincerely believe I did not write it to make money. There's no money in books, in case you don't, in case
Emily,
anybody hears
Emily
thinking about
would
running
know.
Yeah. And I did not write it to feed my ego. It's purely written because this is the advice I wish somebody had given me and saved me a lot of pain and heartache. And if I could give it away for free, I would, but my publisher won't let me. And if I hadn't hired a publisher, I never would have written it. So yeah, some of my favorites, and this list will be on the resources version of the website that comes out after the book comes out. But there's a What to Charge by Lori Lewis, The Designer's Guide to Marketing and Pricing, which is Elise Benin, The Wealthy Freelancer by Steve Slonwhite, which is really, really good book on the mindset stuff. Creative Inc., which is really good if you do a lot of art stuff. I cannot pronounce Joy and Meg's last names. Just look up Creative Inc. It's blue. Design is a Job by Mike Montero, which is one of the Event Apart books. It's probably the one I would tell you to go read first. He doesn't break down pricing as much as mindset, and the guy's just, he's a genius. And there's a guy named Brennan Dunn that has a thing called Double Your Freelancing Rate. We overlap some. His book is more of a course. It's really expensive. And I'm not trying to take his market. He's brilliant. Super nice guy, too. His stuff's worth the money if you want to invest it in it. We're not covering the same things in a lot of ways. Dan Mall has a pricing book on A Book Apart as well. I love Dan. He's a great guy. I disagree with him on a lot of stuff, and I just caution that. I hate to say that to an audience of developers. He's a great guy.
No, but that's amazing. I love the fact that...
Yeah.
You can state that because at the end of the day, you're saying your piece and your information. And it's like we just need to customize the information that makes sense to us. Like Emily and I customized your estimating sheet for us. So that's probably another thing our listeners should know. Like whatever works for you, that resonated with you, use that. And if it doesn't work for you, then get rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the books are great. And I think books are good for this because you need time to process it. You know, and unfortunately, there are not conferences for this. There used to be a Mind Your Own Business thing that AIGA or HAL did. HAL, which is, you know, a huge conference, like 4,000, you know, designers, developers, they have a good business track. I'm speaking there this year, but actually about UX, not business. But their business track is good. I wish more conferences would ask people like me and the people who wrote these books to come talk about mm-hmm. this instead of, you know, another code talk. And code talks are great, but you're not going to learn how to code something in 45 minutes per se. But I mean, not to sound egotistical, but like with you guys, I mean, in an hour or 2 hours of somebody's time, I can fundamentally change their mindset on their business that allows them to write better code and write articles for those developers. And I wish we got invited to do more of that stuff. But, you know, there's some online courses out there. Brennan's, there's a guy named Paul Jarvis that has a great course. He's really, really good. There's a group called The New School that I disagree with them on a lot of stuff as well. They have some of the same ideas as Dan's, which I think they're a little bit too emotional, but they're really good. Their content's solid. And I'm teaching this as a workshop. You can Converge Southeast in Columbia, South Carolina in April. I teach it at General Assembly here in Atlanta, Future Insights Live in Las Vegas, Yellow Conference in Los Angeles. And if you go on the Creative Truth website, I'm going to list, you know, the workshops and appearances. It's a full-day workshop, and we dive deep, and you come out of it with all of this stuff. So take 8 hours out of the office, you come out, and you know where you're going, and that's a commitment. And I'll go do it for people. If a group can get me up there and it makes financial sense to do it, I'll travel and come do it. It doesn't have to be at a conference. And then I'm going to hopefully have this up on some snippets of this on Skillshare in the next couple months. I'm working with them right now. And then there'll be an online course at some point for people who can't travel or can't afford it. And I truly believe in, you know, getting this advice to as many people as possible. If you're struggling financially, asking you to spend thousands of dollars on going to a conference is probably a big ask. So within reason for it to make sense to take out the time and the production and all that stuff to put it out there, just like why I wrote a book that you can buy for $30 instead of one of these $300 books like a lot of gurus tend to do, and they want you to sign up for all this stuff. I'm not doing that. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's fine. But if you go on the Creative Truth website, sign up for the newsletter, I will not spam you. It will be this stuff. I will talk about other people's books. I will give you these tips. It's not a bait and switch kind of thing. I just want this stuff out there and for people to keep doing good work and make money at it.
I'm extremely appreciative of you not only sharing this, you know, through the book, but also taking the time with us on the podcast and our, you know, one-on-one that we had before. But, you know, I just think it's one of those things that it's missing, and I'm glad you're putting it out there because, and I hope more people get more open and transparent with how they operate their creative services agencies, because everything that we can do to make our individual businesses better improves our industry as a whole.
Totally. Absolutely.
And operating smartly and providing real value to our clients and earning what we deserve from that is critical. It's not just the work.
Yeah, spot on.
So before we finish up, we've got our rapid fire 10 questions so our listeners can get to know you a bit better.
Okay.
Are you ready, Brad?
I am, and I have no idea what these are. So.
Okay. Okay, first question, morning person or a night owl?
Morning person, big time.
What's one of your guilty pleasures?
I actually like a lot of pop music.
What software could you not live without?
Slack.
What profession other than your own would you like to try?
I'm going to cheat and say writer, even though I wrote a book, but I do want to write fiction. Yeah.
Very cool. What profession would you not like to try?
Web developer. No, I mean, I am a front-end dev, but man, oof, the hard stuff, no thanks.
If you could take us to one restaurant in your town, where would we go?
Hankook Takiera. It's a Korean taco place. Favorite joint.
Awesome. If you could meet someone famous, living or dead, who would it be?
Wow. Dead, Teddy Roosevelt. Living, no idea.
If you could have a superpower, what would it be?
Mind reading.
What is your favorite band or musician?
My favorite band, it changes every day. My favorite band at the moment right now is Churches. I'm a longtime Josh Ritter fan as well. Yeah.
All right, last question. Pancakes or waffles?
Pancakes all the way.
Nice. So that's all the time we have for today. Thanks for being on the show, Brad.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
In case our listeners want to follow up with you, where can they find you online?
Twitter is S Brad Weaver. So it's just letter S in front of my name. The creativetruth.com website. My company is Nine Labs, ninelabs.com. I'm on Facebook. I'm Don't Be Shy. And, you know, just out there, I speak at a lot of conferences. Speaking list is on the Creative Truth website, and come meet me and hang out.
Thanks again, Brad. This was really fantastic, and I know it's going to help a lot of our listeners.
Awesome. I'm glad to hear that.
Control Click is produced by Bright Umbrella, a web services agency obsessed with happy clients. Today's podcast would not be possible without the support of this episode's sponsor. Thank you, Mithra 62.
We'd also like to thank our partners, Arcus Tech and Devotee.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. If you want to know more about Control Click, make sure you follow us on Twitter at Control Clickcast or visit our website, controlclickcast.com. And if you like this episode, please give us a review on Stitcher or iTunes or both.
Don't forget to tune in to our next episode when we'll be looking at the flexible box model in CSS with Zoe Gillenwater. Be sure to check out our schedule on our site, controlclickcast.com/schedule, for other upcoming topics.
This is Leah Alcantara.
And Emily Lewis.
Signing off for Control Clickcast. See you next time.
Cheers.